Sky News Centre at 6. Boris Johnson's trying to convince MPs from all parties to support his new Brexit deal. The Commons will vote on the agreement tomorrow, the first Saturday sitting since 1982. But before that, they'll decide on whether to approve an amendment which would trigger an extension to Brexit in the event of a no deal. It's been drafted by independent MP and former Conservative Sir Oliver Letwin.
We're creating, in other words, a sustained insurance policy, which means if something goes wrong with the legislation, then we will be sure that the country will still be in the EU after the 31st of October until we've found some other way of getting out conveniently.
A judge has rejected a move by Remain campaigners to suspend the Prime Minister's EU withdrawal agreement. They asked the Court of Session to rule it was unlawful because it didn't comply with UK trade laws. A man who murdered a university lecturer in an attempt to inherit his house and savings has been jailed for at least 36 years. Benjamin Fields subjected Peter Farker to a physical and mental torture in a Buckinghamshire village. An Extinction Rebellion protester in a Boris Johnson wig has climbed up Big Ben. Tree surgeon Ben Atkinson is currently sat on the scaffolding which surrounds Parliament's Elizabeth Tower. He's unfurled two banners criticising the government's lack of action on the climate crisis. Ben says the Prime Minister's focusing on the wrong issue.
He needs to get past Brexit and start thinking about the sixth mass extinction event that's happening as we speak. And it's not as dramatic, it's not happening as quickly, but it's a lot more important.
Meghan's admitted she's really not okay after revealing life in the public eye and being a new mum has been a struggle. She's told a TV documentary which airs this weekend about feeling really vulnerable. And a number of animal charities have welcomed Sainsbury's decision to stop selling fireworks. The store has become the first major British supermarket to make the move. That's the latest. I'm Kat Suave.
During the Second World War, she was recruited by French military intelligence to collect what information she could about German troop locations from officials she met at parties.
Love Bristol. Love. BCFM. 93.2.
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's politics show. I'm Tony Gosling. And helping me review this week's news are Lib Dem Lord Mayor of Bristol, Jos Clark, and North Devon prospective parliamentary candidate for the Brexit Party, Ian Barclay. Retired international relations lecturer and author Ron Mandel is here too. No Martin tonight. He may be back next week, but last week he gave me a practical exercise in smacking, which I did not appreciate. Luckily, no bruises. After the US-owned Comcast News at 7, will the new Hinkley C nuclear power station ever happen? Is it a marvellous alternative to fossil fuels or an outdated, expensive and environmentally destructive way to make electricity? Which those with vested interests refuse to admit is a white elephant. Plus Prometheus, invoked at the United Nations by Boris Johnson in his General Assembly speech a fortnight ago. Who is Prometheus and what is the Prometheus Project? US Rabbi Michael Lerner is author of The Left Hand of God, and he has some observations about what a lack of spirituality in our national culture and at the BBC, etc., means for our aspirations as a people. And the power of debate, what the lies and trivia in the mass media, dumbing down, really means. That That's all in the second hour after the US-owned Comcast News at 7. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 9 Celsius and light rain. This weekend, highs of 14, light cloud and a moderate breeze, but not too rainy. This week, that's highs around 14 again, some sunny spells and patchy rain at the beginning of the week. Next weekend, the 26th and 27th of October, highs around 14 Celsius, mainly cloudy. I think it's next weekend, the clocks go back, isn't it? That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So joining me to review this week's news is Lib Dem Lord Mayor of Bristol, Jos Clark, and North Devon prospective parliamentary candidate for the Brexit Party, Ian Barclay. Now, Ian, you first of all said there that I got your name slightly wrong.
Yes, it's Barclayhurst, but I'm happy to be called Ian.
Can you tell us a bit about yourself? What is your background?
Well, my background starts off from selling flowers in the markets many, many years ago. Went out to Japan, traded over there. Came back to England and decided to become a barrister. Did 3 A-levels as a mature student. Ended up in Exeter University. Found the bar wasn't my home, so I became a solicitor.
So what did you not like about the bar?
I suppose it's not very social in terms of having a family. Young family, if you want to make a career at the bar when you're 30 years of age and you get there and you have a young family, it doesn't work. As a lot of people find, I think you'll find the same happens for people in Parliament as well.
So you're painting a picture of barrow boy to barrister, is that right?
Something like that, with a solicitor in between.
Okay, and what sort of cases were you doing as a solicitor?
I deal mostly with children, childcare matters for local authorities, dealing with social workers, that sort of area.
What do you make of the family courts? There's a lot of criticism, including the head judge from the family courts as well has been quite critical.
I think you've got to look first at the funding, which has been cut back. So my experience in the last two and a half, 3 years, is people are left on their own to defend themselves. We have childcare cases going through to county court. Judges are not able to control it because the individuals are not having lawyers represent them. That's a political decision, and they've been put in the corner and left to take the price of a government that's not prepared to spend the money on legal aid. So that's that. Looking at your judiciary, it is, and we've just changed over in the family side from one head to another. It's bedding in, the system's bedding in, but there are a lot of problems within the court structure that does need reviewing. So it's an issue I'm actually interested in.
What about the whole case of child sexual abuse? Because one of the most worrying things about our family court system at the moment is that you've got children being taken away from their natural parents to be put in care homes. Those care homes, some of them, those children are then being taken from there to be abused. So quite what extent this is happening now is just not known. But the whole idea of a care home seems to have got a very, very tainted image, particularly since the whole expose of Jimmy Savile.
I think you're linking two different issues. In terms of children and what is right for children, it's a last resort to remove them from parents. It's a draconian step, as the courts say. And one wouldn't want to move children unless you really have to. In terms of care homes, it's probably better regulation and it's better control. But you're putting two issues. I mean, the Jimmy Savile issue is one issue and it's totally something else.
Well, care homes, what happens when kids are abused in care homes? Because they're seen by some paedophiles as fair game and the parents aren't there to protect them.
It's been changed. There's a lot more regulations now and that's been dealt with. So in terms of where it's going, I think it's been sorted.
Okay, what about why the Brexit Party?
Why the Brexit Party? Because I think it's a party that has a wide range of candidates from a wide range of subjects. We are new, we're dynamic, and we're going to make a difference. And it's a party that appealed to me, as simple as that, whereas the existing parties don't.
What is it about Brexit that appeals to you? Why?
Well, Brexit is a chance for the country to move forwards, the country to unite together and really trade around the world. There's the empire we had, which we need to look at. There's the Commonwealth. There's a lot of things that are positive that this country
surely
has.
We were moving forwards by getting closer to our European friends. I mean, that's through Brussels and through the EU.
I don't think
it's going backwards, going back surely out of the European Union, which we joined.
Well, you could say that, but if you look at the way the Europeans have been trading, in terms of the euro, they've got problems there. The European, as a group, has got problems in terms of political parties, and it's certainly got problems with immigration issues. There's a number of issues in Europe that are not necessarily good for this country, and therefore we took a view and the country took a view, because we didn't have a chance to deal with the Lisbon Treaty when it was given to the other countries. We've had that chance effectively as a country, and we decided to move on when we voted out.
Okay. If you had to name one specific reason why we need to get out of the EU, as you see it, what would that be? If you're just talking to, I mean, we've got Joss sitting here from the Lib Dems. They want to stay. And in fact, they will be getting a lot of votes in the next general election because there's a lot of people out there, particularly in this city, that do want to stay. So what's your main reason for leaving?
The chance to be able to control our future, not being dictated to by Europe, the chance to promote our products, and the chance to move on. I'm waiting for the Lib Dem to come back. We'll have a discussion. But 17.4 million people were given a simple binary choice, in or out, and it was out. And I think the Lib Dems and the other parties, I respect them much more if they'd have got us out and then campaigned to get us in, rather than trying to take it away from us over a three-year period.
Now, Joss, I'm sure you'll have quite a lot to disagree with amongst all that. We've come to an interesting week in this whole process. We're getting towards the end of this month. Let's just assume that this 31st of October deadline, Halloween, actually does mean something. How do you think it's all going?
I knew you were going to ask me that. I mean, obviously, tomorrow is crunch day. I believe that the vote will take place about 2:30 in the afternoon. And I think that that will give us more of a direction of travel. So we'll have an indication as to what the possible outcomes might be. I know we've been having this discussion for an awfully long time now. And every time we say, and the next vote was going to be the definitive vote, and it never is. And it's just the nature of it. But I think tomorrow is going to be pretty crucial.
I'm annoyed because I get annoyed when people on the radio say, I have to say, but I do have to say this, and that is that you, of all of our senior politicians in the city, you, as the Lord Mayor, you chair the full council meetings. Neither the Metro Mayor, nor Marvin Rees, the Mayor of the city, nor any of the six main MPs in Bristol will come onto this programme and talk about Brexit, which I find absolutely extraordinary. Why do you think, I mean, I'll give it the floor to you, Joss, why do you think that they don't want to sit down where you're sitting now and tell the people what they think and what to expect?
The first thing to say is I'm not here in my role as Lord Mayor. As we all know, the role of Lord Mayor is purely ceremonial, so it's not a political role. So I'm here in my guise as Councillor Joss Clark, representing my ward, Brislington West. That's the first thing to say. As a politician, I'm happy to be held to account, obviously, and I think that a robust and healthy debate is really good. Now, the reasons why other people decide not to come on your programme and not to have that full and frank discussion is entirely down to them. You can make your own decisions.
Well, I've had emails in from all of them now, and they've all said, we were not going to explain why, but we're not coming on, and we're not going to discuss this. This is quite extraordinary for me, Ron. All these people, apart from, I think, one, Chris Skidmore from Kingswood. Yeah, he has never come on. But all the rest of them have been on. But when it comes to Brexit, none of them want to talk, Ron. What might that be? Any ideas?
I have no idea why these individuals don't want to appear on your show. Or possibly because they think Brexit is a toxic issue. Or they might be exhausted by it, as I think many people in this country are. This has been going on now for 3 years. And I think the vote tomorrow will probably be closer than most people predict because I think some MPs have been worn down and they basically want to see the back of the issue.
Well, let's have a listen now to what that vote is all about. This is Jean-Claude Juncker, the President of Europe, on Wednesday, explaining that he's got a deal with Boris.
We have a deal. And this deal means that there was no need for any kind of prolongation. This is a fair, a balanced agreement. It is testament to our commitment to finding solutions. It provides certainty where Brexit creates uncertainty. It protects the rights of our citizens, and it protects peace and stability on the island of Ireland. There will be no border on the island of Ireland, and the single market will be protected. The deal is not about us. The deal is about people and peace. And I look forward to continue my conversations with Boris, because we'll start the negotiations on the future relations immediately after the deal will have been approved. We'll start our debates on the 1st of November without interruption. Tonight, together with Michel Barnier, I will explain the deal to the heads of state and government. And of course, it is for both our parliaments to have the final say. It's not only Westminster having to approve the deal being in fact the treaty. It's also up to the European Parliament to do the same. So thank you, Boris, for, I have to say, excellent relations we had throughout the last weeks.
Thank you very much.
Well, that's Boris Johnson. Amazing to hear Juncker patting Boris Johnson on the back, Ron. Saying, well, it's great relations we've had. The point here, though, is if this Parliament votes this out, surely it's dead in the water. It's potential as well that there won't be any extension from the EU. They're just about as fed up with the Brits as we are with the whole Brexit process. So it means that if tomorrow that Parliament throws out this latest deal, that that could mean they get no deal as a result.
You're quite right. I think the Financial Times today had a very interesting piece saying that basically the EU negotiators were very conspicuously quiet or mute on the whole question of the extension. They've kicked that issue into the long grass. So I'm not quite sure why they've done that.
No, I don't know. I can give you a hint there, maybe why. It's because a few weeks ago we saw a top-level Hungarian delegation come to Downing Street, and it may be that Viktor Orban has promised that if there is any attempt for an extension, he will veto it at the EU. So don't the rest of the parliamentarians know this, that they actually could be getting a no deal if they vote this deal out?
Yeah, you're quite right, and it may be playing into the UK's hands. I think, keep in mind, Johnson all along has been blaming the EU for not being a good faith negotiator. And I think now the EU basically has, I think, trumped that argument basically by saying, well, no, we've negotiated a deal, and that's the deal we're going to go forward with. So that makes Johnson's task a bit more difficult to blame the EU if the deal is not approved by Parliament.
So, Ian, what do you think is going to happen tomorrow?
Well, clearly the deal that's back on the table is Theresa May's with two changes, Section 184 and Article 185. And the real issue they've been negotiating is Northern Ireland. If you look at the Northern Ireland element, it leaves the Good Friday Agreement in place. It keeps all parties in Northern Ireland happy, but it doesn't keep the DUP, because ultimately there'll be a vote, whether it's within the Parliament there or it's the referendum, and it's 8 years or 4 years after the period that goes through.
Is it actually possible to satisfy the DUP? They always stand there with their sour faces every time someone comes up with anything, saying, oh dear, no, this isn't good enough.
You've got to sell the deal to everybody in Ireland, North and South, so you've got to have them on board. I think the problem tomorrow is that Boris is trying a sharp trick to get to a position. It's a deal that we as a Brexit party certainly wouldn't support. And it leaves this country, as I think the country will find out in a year or two's time, absolutely at the mercy of the European Union.
So if in 10 days' time we get a no-deal Brexit, will you be happy? Because that looks like it, what might happen tomorrow if this deal is voted out.
Well, we're hoping for it, and we're ready to supply to the country the support it needs. We've got candidates standing in local elections coming up in November 14th. So we know that we will carry on as a party, whatever the result, because it is a long-term project.
Some say this no-deal Brexit, Ian, is going to be a total disaster, an economic disaster. It's going to put up a wall around this country. People and goods are going to find it very difficult to go backwards and forwards. This is going to affect everybody.
Well, if there's no deal and the Europeans are paying duty to come into this country, the government's going to get the duty coming in from the German cars. There's a lot of money coming in there. Australia, New Zealand, certainly America are lining up to do deals with us. I think the scaremongering this time, which is just as bad when we had the referendum, about 800,000 jobs gone, about all kinds of disaster, is just scaremongering. In reality, people get on with life, businesses are moving forward. Many have said they're investing in this country. It's really a very positive point of view from where we are, and I'm amazed that all the parties talking the country down. That's not what this country needs at this point in time.
Joss, for the Lib Dems, are you still bent on the whole idea of just no Brexit at all? Or do you think that this deal has got anything to offer at all?
I think that the deal on the table at the moment is shabby. I think Ireland is it's a fudge, and I can't see in reality how it's workable.
Would nothing satisfy you other than staying in the EU?
Probably not.
Well, that's what the platform your party's standing on, isn't it? So not entirely surprising. Anyway, let's have a listen now to... We haven't got a Labour Party person, member or MP here. So let's have a listen to a Labour point of view from the Stroud MP, David Drew. And here he is on one of the, I think it's BBC Politics or something similar to that a couple of weeks ago.
I should stand on my record. I should stand to have a second referendum. I should vote Remain in that referendum. But I have a problem with the Lib Dems. I mean, Brexit is a consequence of austerity. They spent 5 years really making many people in my constituency's lives that much worse. I get them every time in a surgery. With universal credit, with some of the problems they've done to the job market, they are not what they pretend to be. What we've said is, obviously we've got our party conference. I mean, I hope that actually...
But are you a Remain party or a Leave party?
No, we're a Remain party. We actually canvassed in the last referendum to Remain. The problem with it is, we cannot ignore Leave voters. I mean, people like Jimmy are important. We have to reach out. And that's been the difficulty. The two sides are both intransigent. Look, you cannot
Does that make
run
sense
this
for you,
country.
Jimmy? Are they a Leave party or Remain?
Two things. It doesn't make sense on a number of fronts. One, Jeremy Corbyn, your leader, for 30-odd years, has actually been a Eurosceptic.
Well, I know Jeremy better than most, and I know where he stands on this.
Thank you very much.
That's just a little clip from BBC's local politics programme. Jossie's saying there, you just can't trust the Lib Dems after austerity. They got into bed with the Tories, and that's one of the reasons we've got such enormous inequality and homelessness in our city because of austerity and the Lib Dem-Tory coalition.
I think that's, you know, just harking back to the past. I think what it is doing is actually hiding the inadequacies of the Labour stance at the moment, where they fail to have any kind of cogent consensus and direction because they are a party which has got a leader who believes one thing and the majority of the membership and the MPs believe in something else, and they come up with an incredible fudge about how they're going to move forward and all this sort of thing, and it's just absolutely ridiculous. So what they're trying to do is they go on the attack in order to actually try and to dissuade people from actually addressing their inadequacies.
Ron, what do you make of the Labour Party's position? It's pretty unclear as to which side they're on.
I'm not a member of the Labour Party, so I make that clear. I think the Labour Party is a divided party, just as the Conservatives are, over the question of Brexit. I think Labour has the credit you have to give to Labour is they want to respect the results of the referendum, all right? And I think that's commendable. And many of the marginal seats up north were the strongest supporters of Brexit. And if Labour is going to have any opportunity to win the next election, they have to hold those seats or win those seats. Mm-hmm. So I don't think you could blame Corbyn for the position of the Labour Party. That was a conference decision, all right? The majority of delegates 2 years running have voted for a position. You might disagree with his position, but it's not just Corbyn's position.
So he's not really leading, is he? He's hamstrung by those votes at the conferences.
Yeah, and he's been hamstrung by backbenchers as well, who have basically been pushing for a Remain agenda, who don't want to respect the will of the people expressed in the referendum in 2016. But
there's also the resignation yesterday of Louise Ellman. She's quit over the anti-Semitism concerns within the Labour Party. MP Dame Louise Ellman quit the Labour Party, saying Jeremy Corbyn is not fit to become Prime Minister. Liverpool Riverside MP said in a letter that she had been deeply troubled by the growth of anti-Semitism in Labour in recent years. Sounds to me like a party run in meltdown, actually.
Well, the whole issue of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party is a very difficult issue to actually discuss, possibly in 30 seconds. I think we probably need at least 30 minutes. I think the point about the point I would make is that there's a difference between allegations of anti-Semitism and proven facts of anti-Semitism. There is a process within the Labour Party that has to be exhausted before you can make any definitive decisions about anti-Semitism. And there's another issue here I think we have to be careful of. There are many people who have conflated criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. And I think you have to make a distinction. There's a principled, You could take a principled position of being holding Israel accountable for its treatment of Palestinians without being anti-Semitic.
What do you make of this resignation in the Labour Party, and how seriously do you take, Joss, the accusations of anti-Semitism? Hearing from Ron there that, to a certain extent, we've got questions over whether these allegations are real, because you can make an accusation, but is it actually real? Some say that it's actually more of a witch hunt than anything real in terms of the Labour Party hierarchy being racist and anti-Semitic.
I think it's really sad this day and age that people feel that they have to leave a political party or a group because of anti-Semitism. I think it is really shameful that they haven't got on top of it, and this has been going on for years, and they fail to address it, and I think it just smacks of weak leadership.
Well, some say that it looks like she was going to lose her seat anyway because she wasn't very popular in Liverpool.
She's not the first.
No. Okay, Ian, what do you make of Labour and anti-Semitism?
Well, I prefer not to go down that road. It's a matter they obviously need to deal with themselves. I know our party policy is we don't tolerate any discrimination. It's been clearly spelled out to all of us candidates. And I think it's a question for Labour just to sort out. I really don't want to comment any more than that.
Okay, fair enough. So let's also have a look at some of the other stories from this week. So, hang on. Red faces at Hargreaves Lansdown. Amazing. That's one of our big institutions in the city. Mm. Following the collapse of Neil Woodford's investment empire, a major embarrassment for the Hargreaves Lansdown. The fund supermarket was one of the fallen stock picker's biggest cheerleaders, repeatedly featuring him on its best buy list, despite concerns about his portfolio. So this is people's savings going into Hargreaves Lansdown and then disappearing, effectively. And, Joss, this is a big institution in the city. It's a powerful institution nationally. And the fact of the matter is they were recommending this fund themselves. And all of a sudden we find it's not worth anything. People have lost all their money.
Obviously, it's a great shame, and it's a great shame that it's being associated with Bristol. I mean, Hargreaves Lansdown has a huge reputation in the city and further abroad. And I just think it's really sad that they've obviously made some significant mistakes.
Ron, I don't know if you've been following this, but this story is a national story, really, focused here on in Bristol. We reported several years ago that Rowan Bosworth Davis, in fact, he did an interview for this programme. He was a fraud squad detective in central London. And he said, true or not, we don't know, but he said that he interviewed Peter Hargreaves, three times under caution because of allegations of fraud, and this is back in the 1990s. So these big institutions, we put our money, we put our trust, we put our faith in them. It seems here that Neil Woodford betrayed that trust completely.
Well, there has to be measures basically to hold these firms accountable for misleading people and basically wasting people's investments. I think you need tougher legislation.
Ian, what do you think of Hargreaves Lansdown? We're supposed to trust these people, and then people have just lost everything.
Well, if you look at it, it's 300,000 people that have been affected. People are writing from the Mail to the Financial Times, so it's really a major issue that I think the politicians have ignored in their battle of having arguments about Brexit. The actual effect is people are losing thousands. The company itself made 41 million. The FSA has been trying to get control. It's an ongoing situation that the FSA needs to be reviewed, needs to have stronger powers, and we need to be looking in more detail at what these companies do, because this has clearly been flagged up for some time, and obviously this week with the annual general meeting of that company, which is a major company in Bristol, it's now flagged up. So it's a question of the authorities, government, when we get in as a party, Brexit, reviewing these areas and making sure that the FSA is able to actually do something.
Well, the FSA won't do anything all the time. They're funded by the financial industry, will they?
Well, that's something that we need to debate, make a decision. It's as simple as that.
I mean, why would any organisation that is supposed to regulate an industry, if it's being paid by that industry, the people's wages are being paid by that industry, of course, they're not going to be a very useful regulator.
That's been a matter that's been raised over the years about whistleblowers and other companies that have had these situations and banks. And I think it's something that the Parliament has to sit down and decide, make a decision. And at the end of the day, are we going to spend the money to do it properly via Parliament, or are we going to rely upon the firms themselves to do it? It happens in a number of areas in this country that we sort of give away from Parliament the control because we find somebody else to pay for it.
It wouldn't be that difficult, would it, for Parliament to decide on who runs it and to say to all these banking institutions, you can't actually have a banking licence unless you pay your whatever X into this organisation to regulate you, and the government could actually wouldn't have to pay anything to regulate it in that case.
That's a very good point. But the problem is, with the history of what we have with the financial services, they haven't acted when they should have done, and it's the consumers who end up paying the price.
Also this week, we've had the antics, I have to call them that, of Extinction Rebellion this week up in London, blocking the tube trains, and I think it was very unwise of them to choose the East Enders of Canning Town to jump on top of a tube train, because they then got dragged down. And we'll just talk about the wisdom of this organisation, what they're actually trying to achieve and whether they're going the right way about it. After we hear a little clip from Points West, which mentions a couple of the Extinction Rebellion leaders and founders, who of course are from Bristol and Stroud.
The Stroud co-founder of Extinction Rebellion, Gail Bradbrook, arrested after climbing onto the roof of the Department for Transport. And another West Country protester, Phil Kingston from Bristol, gluing his hand to a train this morning. He was arrested shortly afterwards for the 13th time. Activists say the disruption caused by their actions is nothing compared to the chaos that would be caused by global warming. They want the UK to be carbon neutral by 2025.
I actually think that the actions in London were really ill thought out and actually have probably done them more damage. OK, we're talking about it now and it has been a topic of conversation this week, but if they want people to change hearts and minds and to change the culture in this city and across the world, I don't think that those actions were the right ones. They could have actually been a bit more savvy. I think it was really, really naive.
We also had the attempt to close down Heathrow Airport using drones, didn't we, about a month and a half ago, in which there were something like 10 arrests before anything even happened.
And they're going to, is it London City Airport? They were targeting them, but very particular, because they say it's a high value, high net worth people who are using that airport.
Well, one of the things tactics they were doing was booking a seat on a plane and then causing loads of disruption so the plane can't take off. But that's a very different thing to actually flying drones around, which might be ingested into an engine.
Absolutely.
Of a plane.
I mean, their actions in Bristol, I think initially when they started their activities in Bristol, it was a week long protest, and people were very sympathetic to the cause. They understood the message, but when they actually overstepped the mark by blocking the bottom of the M32, I think they lost a lot of support then. I think they achieved quite a lot by doing it, but they went against police advice. And I think that you do need to work with the police on these things. And, you know, there was a horrendous story that came out of it, obviously, that the guy who couldn't get to a dying relative's bedside.
Ron, if we were Extinction Rebellion campaigners here, should we be talking to the police and asking for their advice about whereabouts we should be demonstrating?
No. As someone who's taken part in direct action, the purpose of direct action is to put pressure on authorities to do something to address the issues that you're raising to your attention. But the point of fact of the Extinction Rebellion, the majority of people actually were opposed to that action that took place on that tube. But the way Extinction Rebellion is organized, it's organized by affinity groups. So you have individual groups which decide on a particular action, and they're not accountable to the large organization. There's no general vote, and so you authorize that particular action. Now, that action, I think, was ill-advised. I do agree. And it backfired, and it's given negative publicity to Extinction Rebellion. But Extinction Rebellion, its aims are basically to, what's the word, draw attention to the seriousness of climate change. And sometimes you have to put people on the spot. And the purpose of their direct action is to do that. And they've been effective in doing that.
It sounds to me like a bit like an agent provocateur's perfect place for them to operate, because you can turn up, you can do something really silly, and then you can say, oh, we're Extinction Rebellion. It's not actually very tightly run, is it?
That's quite right. And that is the problem with these groups. These groups, I took part in a number of actions. And I had a good nose for sniffing out agent provocateurs. But agent provocateurs can't bring disrepute to a movement.
Okay, maybe the Extinction Rebellion could do with you sniffing around. I mean, who knows? Ian, what do you make of this action on the tube? What we saw on TV pictures were Extinction Rebellion activists on top of a tube train actually being dragged off and having things thrown at them initially. But as the number of passengers got more and more and more that needed to travel, they were actually dragged off the tube train onto the platform and apparently kicked as well.
I don't condone anything like that. It shouldn't happen. But the issues they're facing is a worldwide problem. If you look around the world, there's rising tides in parts of the world where they're flooded. There's climate change. It is an issue that the parties have to deal with. And they're not really addressing it. And I know from the conversations I have with people around, they totally support it. They just think it's gone too far in terms of this particular demonstration. We in the Brexit Party are saying, yes, it's got to be a debate with everybody. If we start talking to them and taking them seriously, they will maybe step back and talk to us, because it's something society's got to deal with. Simple as that.
So,
well, I drove in a car. I would agree, but I'd happy to buy a car that was electric if there was one available.
Well, this is exactly the point Joss made there, that the commuters were making to the protesters. How did you get here? Oh, we came on the tube.
I totally agree.
So there seems to be something sort of illogical, counterproductive and chaotic, actually, about what they're up to. So what with Extinction Rebellion and Brexit, is it Armageddon in 10 days' time? Joss?
No.
Ron?
No.
Ian?
No, definitely not.
Okay. Well, it's good to hear. That's good news, isn't it? No Armageddon. But I tell you what, let's have a little bit of music. And this is a band called, what are they called? They're called Harry and Chris. They have a song all about the end of the world.
Pause. Check mine, check yours.
Pause still going.
Thoughts still flowing.
Hair still growing.
What?
Slowly.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, but recently, did you see that thing in the news?
With the dog?
No, the other thing.
I think I did too, with the dude.
And the dude.
And the dog?
No, the nukes.
Not the dog?
No, the nukes.
Okay, what we gonna do?
Well, they both got something to prove.
Tiny hands.
And we could use them to press a big button if they choose.
So before two goons blow up the world around them, we're here to make a quick announcement.
Stop what you're doing, go and tell your friends.
The world is about to end, again.
We know it was before, but this is now and that was then.
The world is about to end, against the
go crazy. There's only a few days left, they want a PDF, just send them a JPEG.
And forget practicing safe sex. There's no time for practice. Just do it badly.
If everything's about to be destroyed anyway, why not find a reckless way to end your days?
Do something you've only ever dreamed of.
And if you can't think of any, try these ones.
Treat yourself to a meal at the end, don't tip, and then use that cash to buy a bag of crisps. A really big bag of crisps. Have a wee without locking the door just for bants.
That is mad.
And then don't wash your hands. Stay up till like 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning, 2:15 in the morning. Ooh. When someone asks you why are you yawning, say we'll sleep when we're dead.
Which might be quite soon. You wanted to date Sam at the office for ages, why not tell him that you'd like to try it? I mean, not to their face, that's properly crazy, but leave them a note, and if the world ends, then they might not find it.
We're saying it's going relatively crazy,
yeah,
in a way that is safe and non-expensive. Just in case you wake up and the world doesn't end, because you will have to live with the consequences.
The world as we know it is over.
Like when I found out race car was a palindrome.
The world as we know it is over.
Like the first time I tried Marmite and cheese.
The world as we know it is over.
Every Wetherspoons has a different carpet.
The world as we know it is over.
And human babies don't have knees.
The world as... Wait, what?
It's just cartilage till they're about three.
Is that
true? I've got a niece, which sounds like knees, which is already confusing. And just some squeezy knees. If you know any babies, ask their parents' permission. Change your life.
Babies don't have knees.
They don't have knees. It's, I do, but I'm grown up.
What would... What we're trying to say is that every day the world changes and ends and begins.
Because every moment is precious.
Don't let boneheads with weapons change the way that you live.
You see, it's less rapture, more new chapter.
Less apocalypse, more just get on with it.
Less Armageddon, more Armageddon on with it.
Well, let's get on with it. Stop what you're doing, go and tell a friend.
The world is about to end again.
We live and we die just like dragonflies.
The world is about to end
again.
Why are they called dragonflies? All dragons fly.
They should just be called mini dragons.
See, the issue with your end of the world predictions,
if it comes true, you might feel conflicted.
Because on the one hand, everyone that you know and love will die.
On the other hand, it is nice to be proved right.
The proof's in the pudding, and the pudding is death. The fact is, as a human race, we have survived so many apocalypses.
Apocalypse.
So forget Rocket Man and some orange guy. Let's go out and get on with our lives. Oh, We're still here.
They said we wouldn't make it, but we're still here.
So many things have tried to take us, but we're still here.
We survived the Cold War.
More like the old war.
We survived smallpox.
I pity the fool pox.
Foot-in-mouth disease.
Foot-in-mouth disease.
Millennium bug.
Millennium shrug. They feel the Earth and a comet might seem to collide, but that meteorite went by with me to your right.
Shout out, who remembers Black Death?
Exactly, everyone is over it. We're still here.
They said we wouldn't make it, but we're still here.
It's time to celebrate the fact that we are still here.
So stop what you're doing, go and tell your friends.
The world's not about to end, we're still here.
Learn from the past, we made it this far.
We've not yet got to the end.
So come out of your bunker, hang out with your friends. The world's not about to end.
There's no time like the present, your life is in session. Maybe the world won't end yet.
That is, or was, Harry and Chris. The song is The End of the World. They're actually brilliant. I heard them on the Billy Quain program last Saturday. He's on every Saturday from 10 till 12 here with the Arts Show. But let's get back to the politics, because this is the politics show, and we had a State of the City address. This is where our Labour Mayor Marvin Rees stands up in front of an audience at the Wills Memorial Building at the top of Park Street and gives them his kind of review of himself and how he's been getting on. So let's have a listen to at least the beginning of that, we'll have one or two clips from that. One of the most controversial things Marvin Rees has done is he's introduced these six thematic boards, he calls them. Rather than having councillors on them, they have people that Marvin has invited to sit on them. So it's a sort of invite-only bunch of Marvin's mates that are designed, apparently, to come up with policy to run the city. So let's have a listen to what he had to say about these boards now.
We have shared city leadership with six thematic boards made up of partners from right across the city, each taking responsibility for shaping and updating their piece of the Bristol One City Plan. Therein is inclusive, cross-organisational work going on in a way it never has. And we have the city funds, which will be investing in agreed city priorities with ethical investment and giving at its heart. The significance of these innovations should not be underestimated. These successes have been recognised around the world, from the EU's iCapital Awards to the Financial Times and Reuters. Now, all of these achievements can't be taken for granted. Delivery has not previously been the norm, and sustaining the city office and the One City plans needs the new form of political leadership we have brought. But let me share a few reflections. It means delivery being delivery focused. You would be surprised how often we have come into conflict with processes that prioritise the structures rather than outcomes for people. Secondly, it means we must go beyond the transactional relationship between candidate and voters, where a candidate promises a couple of projects to purchase a vote. Our offer as an administration is this: a working relationship built on a shared set of priorities and values and a commitment to delivering against them.
So that's the Bristol Mayor, Marvin Rees, talking about his six, thematic boards, they're called, Joss. What are these?
It's all part of our One City plan, I believe. which is obviously reaching out to our partners across the city to deliver services. So it's about partnership working.
Marvin talks about we all the time. It's almost like the royal we, rather than talking about... Yeah, but actually, he himself has quite a lot of power in all this, hasn't he?
He has a lot of power in this. I mean, obviously, he's setting up the One City... He set up the One City plan, and he's hoping to deliver on it. But we do have some real projects which have gone singly...
Well, the money has been thrown away, effectively.
Yes.
Well, which is obviously, you know, particularly with council tax, people paying council tax who are on quite low incomes, they resent that money then being poured down the drain. What's happened over the spatial strategy?
Spatial strategy is one area which I think that the West of England, so the four unitary authorities, including Bristol, we have just wasted a serious amount of money. Full council, I'm sure there will be questions being asked about exactly how much the Bristol has had to invest in a plan which has been effectively ditched.
But that's central government's fault, isn't it? It's not Bristol's fault.
Why would you say it's central government?
Isn't it the planning inspectorate or something?
It's the planning inspectorate that threw it out because it said it was so flawed that it's not even worth amending. And that's not... Is that the planning inspector's fault or is it the person who wrote it?
Maybe the person who wrote it.
Possibly.
Ron, what do you make of the idea of setting up these boards across the city, which is really out with the council's constitution, where to look at specific areas all chosen by the mayor personally, his own, you know, chums, I suppose?
Well, I don't know. They could be experts, but there's a distress among the general population about experts because we don't know what they're expert on. And there's, I think, a more serious question about how accountable these people will be. Who are they accountable to? Just the mayor? And I think that's a serious question. Who are they representing? Are they representing vested interests? Are they representing communities which have a stake in the future of the city?
Well, they seem to be also either friends of Marvin or friends of Business West. I'm not sure. But councillors aren't being put on these boards, Joss, are they?
No, they're not. And that actually, I don't think, is democratic, because the whole point of having councillors is to have democratic accountability, and also so that you actually have an ability to scrutinise things as they're going through.
Ian, what do you make of this? It sounds almost like the Mayor Marvin Rees is a chief executive running a factory rather than a city.
I thought that his way of dealing with the council is to try and put a position where the government would have to give him more money, so he's politically running it, he's not socially running it. I spoke to somebody locally called Jessica Hodge, who gave me a couple of questions to put forwards. And she pointed out, and I know the One City plan's been raised, but what are they going to do as a plan to actually meet the target for the homeless side of this by 2027? So when you look around, people are not getting the services they need because there's a political agenda from this particular mayor. I know nearly 27 million has gone into the energy company, which the idea was quite good. It was the 100 UK group to supply energy to people on lower incomes. But it's actually costing £177 per consumer to run this business. They've spent 11.2 million in the last year. That money should be going towards the social services, to social workers, 22% turnover rate of those, carrying 25 cases. So the decisions being made at the top, with all these political parties, is having a massive impact on the people that live in Bristol.
Joss, you know, the council holds on to our money. It's a massive pot of money, but it's like a colander with holes. Ian's just explained how the energy company is leaking money. There may be no prospect that that money's ever going to come back. And we've also heard from you about the spatial strategy. It doesn't sound as if our money's being very well managed by Marvin Rees.
The energy company has been an ongoing saga for many years.
I must say, by the way, I did ask them about a month ago to come on and discuss what was happening with the energy company, and they have just simply refused. They strung me along and along and along, as Hibak Jama and certain other councillors have done, and they just simply will not come on the radio and explain, which is amazing because it's an opportunity for them, one would have thought, to sell it, to say, hey guys, this is a great idea, come and have why don't you buy into the energy company? But they're not interested in talking on this programme.
The problem with the energy company is it's actually, it's a real shame, but it's an energy company that was developed for the population of Bristol, and it's not actually the cheapest energy company out there. I used to be a customer. I'm no longer a customer because I can get my energy supplied cheaper elsewhere. We're just pouring money into it year on year, and the chances of it ever breaking even are slim.
Well, we talked about Extinction Rebellion a minute ago, and there is this slight problem with, because of course Marvin Rees, he goes along to quite a lot of these Extinction Rebellion meetings, the mayor, is this problem, Ron, where they're saying we need to be carbon neutral by 2025. That's just about 5 years' time. That means pretty much no car, no petrol or diesel cars, no gas central heating. Well, I mean, it doesn't... I mean, it would be... First of all, is it desirable? And secondly, is it possible?
Well, I think it's a noble aim, but I think it's a fantasy that we're going to achieve that in 5 years. I think that as a society, I don't think we're coming to grips with the possible consequences of climate change. And I think until it's smack right in your front of you, I don't think the drastic and radical measures will be taken. So I think 5 years is too short a time to achieve that.
I am really concerned about this because the council has a propensity to, or we're looking at building more roads. What happens if you build more roads? People put more cars on them. We get greater increase in pollution. I mean, where I live in Brislington, we have incredibly high pollution levels. We are not addressing it. The way to address it is by getting better services, public transport services, and people. Because then you get people out of their cars, and they naturally move out of their cars, and they move around the city much, much more freer.
So I hope, as Lord Mayor, you will be getting rid of your central heating gas boiler in the next 3 or 4 years, will you?
I will be looking at alternatives. I do drive a 100% electric car. I do have solar panels. I do have a very well-insulated house. I hope I'm doing my bit. I'm hoping that my solar panels are charging my car in my garage.
But not everyone can do these things.
No.
Do you think the aims of Extinction Rebellion are realistic?
Are they actually
achievable?
We need to, as you're absolutely right in saying that we do have a crisis looming and people do need to get real about it. But it's the push-pull argument, isn't it? At the moment, we've got a local authority that's very keen on building more roads. We know that's going to generate more traffic. We are not actually looking at the consequences and moving people away from their current behaviour and practice. Building more roads, giving more opportunities to drive on them rather than giving alternatives like public transport is the way forward.
Well, I agree. Maybe even nationalise it too, make it free like Ken Livingstone tried to do in London. Anyway, Ian, what do you make of the aims? Are they realistic aims or not?
I think you've got to set high targets, and if you get halfway there, you're doing better than not trying to start with. So you really have to set the highest benchmark, and then you have to work with industry, you have to work with the people in society, and you have to change it so they don't have to commute to jobs, they can live where the jobs are.
Would you agree with the mayor's proposal here to charge all diesel vehicles coming into the city, even if they've got these particulate filters and the very latest technology?
I think he's going the wrong way about it, because if you look at the technology now with diesel cars, they are cleaner than some petrol cars, and there's different areas of pollution they create. So it's not a simple ban this car or tax it. It's looking at working with industry and going forward in that particular area. But overall, we've got to look at the costs of production, which at the moment uses a lot of carbon, and persuade businesses to invest in alternative ways of producing the goods we need. This is really going to take us as a country sit down together and work with the various parts. Brexit Party is prepared to do that. I don't see the other parties actually doing it.
The reason I brought XR back up again is because the climate emergency was discussed by Marvin Rees in his State of the City speech this week.
Declarations and motions are only the first step. The climate emergency requires action. We have the action plan which has been published today on the Council's website, from setting a groundbreaking ambition for a carbon neutral and climate resilient city by 2030 to driving forward a £1 billion programme of investment in cleaner, greener energy to progressing the actions requested of councils by Friends of the Earth. We are telling the truth about climate emergency and acting now to tackle it in concert with the link challenge of social justice.
We will finalise our local plan to ensure our planning policies match our ambition. New planning policy will drive zero carbon buildings, affordable housing, community self-build and appropriate student developments. We will find a way to make Bristol a plastic-free city, and we are going for gold on food sustainability and have plans with the Avon Wildlife Trust and food growing groups to establish local food growing in every ward in the city, tackling food poverty while protecting wildlife habitats. Now, to finish off, it's worth just sharing that City Hall is about to install a blue plaque declaring Bristol a city of hope. Now, it was presented to Bristol at the July City Gathering in recognition of what we have all been doing and actually challenging us to keep going on the things we have been doing for the people of Bristol. Now, we have the opportunity to make Bristol a better place for all citizens of all ages throughout their lives. From childcare and children's centres to more and better schools, a diverse, inclusive and sustainable economy with jobs for all, a transport system that is fit for purpose, connecting people and jobs and cleaning our air, to keeping people in their own homes with better support. To deliver that city, we need to continue the change we've started. Now, I started tonight by telling a story of a Bristol mum who was struggling to feed her children today. And I shared that 40 years ago, my mum was facing the same struggle. We don't want to be telling that story again in 40 years. We have the opportunity now to make Bristol a better place to live and work for all our citizens. Let's continue to change. Let's do it together. Thank you.
So I think that working in partnership with communities, listening to the voice of communities is really admirable. But I think when a community gets together and they set up what's called a neighbourhood plan, which means that a community has a say into what happens in their neighbourhood in terms of infrastructure and development. And so which we've had in Hengrove Park, they've just had a neighbourhood plan, and the council have just ridden roughshod over that plan by pushing through a development on Hengrove Park.
It sounds to me like the State of the City address is just words. I mean, it's sort of talking it up, almost like trying to do a marketing pitch for Bristol.
Well, it is. It's about we need to work with individuals. We need to work with communities to actually affect change. But when a community takes hold of a plan and they want their area to be better and to be served better, and then the city doesn't listen to it and they just put in planning for thousands of houses, then I think that people get a bit disillusioned with it.
Ron, with an event like this, you would expect some sort of maybe some questions and answers afterwards. But no, what we get is we get Andrew Kelly, who I work with, who was paid by the City Council and various other bodies, the Arts Council, etc., Business West. But he was line managed by Business West to organise the Festival of Ideas. He's now organising something else as well called the Festival of the Future City. He brings in people from the United States, so an anti-China person, an anti-Turkey person, to sit and have a little chit-chat on the stage. There's no questioning from the audiences, but we did get told that, well, if anyone that sent questions in for the question and answer session afterwards, sorry, but you will get answers to your questions next week. It's not really a chance to interrogate the mayor. It's just, it seems to me, him telling us what he wants us to hear, and there's no kind of feedback at all in this process.
Listening to what he had to say, I was torn between crediting him with being a visionary and being a cynic. You know, I didn't know how to react to his speech. I would think, yes, he wants to raise people's expectations. He wants to inspire people to take action. He wants people to feel confident about the city council. But I think listening to him, my reaction would be, I think you need to be a bit more realistic. Just to give you one example, I was waiting for a bus today, and I saw, I would say, at least 100 cars go by. And out of those 100 cars, 67, 68 cars were only driven, operated cars. There was no passengers. All right. Until we deal with that issue, and you know, we have to break free of the automobile dependency. We need to have mass transit. And that's something I think the city council can do. They could basically invest more in mass transit, make it more possible for people to use bicycles and alternative modes of transport. That one, I think, would make more sense than
I'm surprised the mayor has not invited you onto his special little group to look at transport as one of his pals, Ron, because this is something millions of people, hundreds of thousands of people across this city are thinking. Anyway, what's your take, Ian, finally, on the mayor's speech there?
I think it's very good. He's set in a position. I just look at what he's done previously in actually getting to what he's going to do. There's questions over developments and involvements and council staff going on to work for private companies in Malaysia. There's questions about him delaying sorting out the pollution from cars. He's not actually producing the results, and he's been around long enough to produce them. So while it's good, and I would totally support where he's going, it's not working.
Okay, thanks to our guests, Lib Dem Lord Mayor of Bristol, Jos Clark, as well as being a councillor, of course, up in Brislington, and North Devon prospective parliamentary candidate for the Brexit Party, Ian Barclay. Join Ron and I after the news as we take our weekly look around the world.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.